The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Derek Frost for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, Olson's Ambitious Journey. Todd Olson is crafting a robust plan for Pendo after learning from his earlier failures as an entrepreneur. And the cover story begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with the second headline, Don't Tell Olson He Can't Do It. Pendo is elevating Raleigh's entrepreneurial reputation, maybe the next SaaS, maybe the next Red Hat. And this is written by Lauren Onasorge. From a failed startup in a university basement to a tech company in a Raleigh high-rise surrounded by IPO chatter, Todd Olson's decades-long rise from whiz kid to CEO has been rocky. Olson's journey, like that of many entrepreneurs, has been marked by failure. His first startup flopped. His second had what he described as a soft landing. But through it all, investors kept taking million-dollar bets, leading Olson to where he is now, running Pendo, a software company valued at $2.6 billion that may be the tech brand to elevate Raleigh's entrepreneurial reputation, maybe the next SaaS, maybe the next Red Hat. Pendo is the realization of a lifelong dream for Olson, 46, a CEO with a reputation as a direct, impassioned leader. Pendo creates analytics software that helps customers make product decisions. Fortune 500 firms use its feedback software to understand how their products resonate with customers. And 2022 is a critical year for the company, which crossed the $100 million annual recurring revenue mark and raised $150 million in 2021, less than 2 years after a $100 million raise. And with the big money comes big expectations. In year nine, many startups are folding up shop. Others are failing, looking for a lifeline, be it a deal or venture capital, to take it to a decade. But not 900-employee Pendo, which has been beefing up its C-suite with IPO experience, even as it moves to the downtown skyscraper that now bears its name. Olson, who has a wife and four children, has made a home in Raleigh, which is where he says Pendo will stay. Exit talk is constant as investors, employees, and the Triangle watch for what Olson will do next. The Whiz Kid. Olson grew up in a Delaware suburb just 40 minutes south of Philadelphia. At the age of 8, he wanted to go into politics. As he grew, the dream evolved. He wanted to be a manager, a business owner, perhaps a leader at a big company. Olson got his corporate start at age 14 when his mother was talking to a neighbor who just happened to work at MBNA Bank, headquartered in Wilmington, Delaware. Olson, a dabbler at programming, joined the bank, gradually taking on more and more responsibilities as his programming skills improved. He was hooked. For his first few months, Olson automated jobs using spreadsheets. He was the whiz kid immersed in how automation could save the bank real dollars. When he enrolled at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, the bank bought him a laptop, so I could consult with them on weekends, which he did for 2 years. But college changed his mindset. I quickly learned that I wasn't a banker, he says. He turned down a management training program and left the bank. I was more passionate about technology, Olson says. The co-founder. Olson met Eric Boduck, his co-founder at Pendo, in his senior year at the school's entrepreneurship club. Boduck had heard of how Olson had been programming professionally since 14. Boduck had started programming on an Apple II computer in middle school. But I was doing it for fun, Boduck said. He was getting paid real money for it. The internet was brand new in 1996. Boduck was starting an internet consulting company and asked Olson to join. I was really young, going to old big companies teaching them. This is what the internet is and how I can use it, Olson says. It was the life for a while. Think $20 an hour when most college kids were making $4.25. It was much better than working at the cafe around the corner and getting paid minimum wage, Boduck recalls. Olson turned down an offer from Netscape, dropped to a part-time student, and deferred plans to earn a master's degree, totally bitten by the entrepreneurship bug. From the basement of some crappy building on campus, he says, Olson and Boduck tapped at the keys, paying less and less attention to the clock. Those were the days where I would probably work all-nighters every night, Olson says. You couldn't tear me away from the office. But it wasn't enough. He wanted to build a product from scratch instead of one-off projects and started seeing patterns around crunching data. Ideas started to form. Olson, then a cocky 20-something, raised his first round of funding, approaching friends and family and assembling his first $100,000 to create Cerebellum Software. Our pitch was like, hey, there's this thing called the internet. It's going to be very different going forward, and we see this ability to create infrastructure, he says. But Olson and Boduck had never started a company, and despite the bravado in their pitch, neither of us in many, many ways knew what we were doing, Olson says. The company flopped. The dot-com bubble burst. Family and friends who wrote checks lost every dollar. Olson's voice changes even now when he talks about it, the feeling of failing. The company had raised just under $10 million, primarily from venture capitalists, but it's those early investors that stick in his mind. We couldn't figure out how to sell it, he says. If I knew then what I knew now, obviously things would have been a lot different. Boduck remembers it similarly. The bust time is a lot less fun than the boom time, he says. And you started thinking about all the money you left on the table. It's rough for anyone, especially when all you've seen was the good times. The company had about 75 people, and Olson remembers staying up late trying to figure a way out. One finally came, an offer Olson says was about $80 million from a company called Silverstream. Olson sourced it personally, cold calling a chief technology officer. The board, however, thought he was too young to negotiate such a big transaction. Olson still grits his teeth at the memory of how the investment banker came in and insulted the CEO of the other company with a counteroffer and tanked the whole thing. Everything had been steered toward a buyout. There was no backup plan. Boduck left the company. Olson had to lay off 20 people in a single day. The company shuttered. Brutal, Olson recalls. It took gumption moving on from such a loss, Boduck says. It's just being brave, Boduck says. People can be brave in different ways, but there's just something about being an entrepreneur. While Boduck returned to consulting, Olson connected with a former Cerebellum partner, TogetherSoft, a business processing automation company. The firm flew Olson to its home base of Raleigh, offering him a job. Olson took it, leaving his friends, his family, everything I knew to go to this place, Raleigh, in 2001. The executive. When Olson came to Raleigh, he had never left the country. TogetherSoft had him responsible for a team of 250 in St. Petersburg, Russia. Suddenly, Olson was flying frequently between two very unfamiliar places, Raleigh and Russia, and he had a team in Prague. Today, he finds the geopolitical situation in Russia the antithesis of what he used to know. I just enjoyed my time there, he says. I had such a big team, I felt like we could build anything. It was a complete 180 from Cerebellum, where he had to personally build everything code by code. Now he had a huge team to manage. He wasn't the founder. He wasn't a technologist. He was a manager managing managers, three levels removed from the people tapping the keys, all at age 26. If I hadn't had that experience, I don't know if I would have learned to manage, Olson says. He focused on delivery. How could TogetherSoft become a leader? And he was given the autonomy to do what he thought needed to be done. Colleagues say Olson could cut through the bull, communicating to a team without paragraphs of exposition, but the entrepreneurial itch remained. In 2002, Borland Software acquired TogetherSoft in a deal valued at $185 million. Olson remained for over a year as chief scientist, but found it less fun. I just really wanted to start a company, he says. So, Sixth Sense Analytics became his second company as a co-founder. The firm scored capital from InterSouth Partners in Durham, and Olson got to be a technologist again with his first foray into analytics and software as a service. InterSouth's Mitch Mumma says Olson was impressive in early-stage meetings. It was worth the bet, Mumma says. Olson was open about his past failure, and Mumma saw it as a learning milestone. You learn a lot from failure. You learn a lot more from failure than from success, Mama says. To build a truly, truly great company, it's a get-rich-slow scheme. But Olson says he made mistakes. He hired a CEO who was a salesperson who felt inclined to sell before the product was shipping. He gave unrealistic expectations to investors, and Olson thought the revenue timing would happen faster, and that belief hurt us, he says. Olson had to scale back the company and take on the CEO role. By 2008, Sixth Sense had just 6 months of cash. He couldn't raise capital. Options were limited. So I decided to try selling the company, he recalls. After turning down Raleigh the first time, he circled back. He wanted continuity for the employees who were left, and Raleigh could offer that. Olson says the key to retention was transparency. He told employees what the cash situation was, and he pledged that they would find a home for every single person. And our investors ultimately made money, he says. Raleigh went public in 2013, raising $84 million. Was it the outcome I wanted or envisioned? No, he says of Sixth Sense. It's what we call in the startup business a soft landing. At Rally, Olson rose up the ranks, becoming vice president of products by 2011. In that role, he got his next idea for what would become Pendo when seeing there was a disconnect when releasing products. Olson recalls in one case, after shipping a big product feature, he only learned months later that people weren't adopting it in the way Rally expected. Salespeople were telling us great things, everyone loves it, and it's flying off the shelf, he says, but reality was different from the noise. It made it tough to make decisions. Olson remembers being frustrated when trying to make a pricing change and having no data available. There had to be a better way, he thought. We've got to find a way to educate users better, Olson says. As that idea was percolating, Rally was changing. When it filed to go public, the chief financial officer brought Olson in to be a part of the process, giving him a very front seat to an IPO. It serves me well today, he says. Olson left soon after, ringing the IPO bell. The CEO. Olson called Bodak, who was also looking for an opportunity. They teamed up with Rahul Jain, a former venture capitalist who invested in Sixth Sense. A mutual friend introduced the trio to Eric Trone, new chief technology officer at Pendo, and they started brainstorming. Timing is such an important thing, Olson says. We had space in our lives to do something next. It was just a good balance of skill sets. And the idea he had while at Rally, there had to be a better way, returned like a whisper in his head. They took the plunge and Pendo was born. Product fit was part of the conversation from day one as Olson dissected mistake after mistake he had made at previous startups. At Pendo, Olson's closest friends saw him as a leader. Bodak knew Olson could lead teams, but even he was impressed when watching Olson sell. Todd is good in front of customers. I always knew that, but he's actually good at closing business too, Bodak says. The company started small at a co-working space now known as Raleigh Founded that was co-founded by Jesse Lipson, the entrepreneur behind ShareFile, later bought out by Citrix. We saw what a big impact ShareFile and Citrix had on the city with kind of developing the warehouse district, Lipson says. We were really hoping in creating Raleigh Founded the next ShareFile would come out. Pendo could be the culmination of that vision, Lipson says. They're on their way to being bigger than ShareFile ever was, he says. Pendo was founded in 2013. By the end of 2018, it would promise 590 jobs in exchange for $11 million in incentives from the state of North Carolina. As of this year, it is based in its downtown Raleigh headquarters. Its headcount is now nearly 900. Meanwhile, Bodak watched Olson go from being very hand-on to a leader who delegates. What's been impressive about Todd's management style is that it's adjusted with the company, Bodak says. He describes Olson as a blunt, honest leader. You generally always know what Todd thinks about a particular issue, Bodak says. Olson will guide a discussion, but he'll listen too, colleagues say. But with growth comes noise. Lipson warns that it's easy to get distracted at the top and says it is critical to stick to your values. It's just always focusing back on making customers happy, sticking to the core values, Lipson says. Olson says culture is part of the strategy. The firm's signature pink color, Olson's idea, Bodak says, is everywhere in its new headquarters. As a treat for customers, Pendo teamed up with 321 Coffee, which hires workers with intellectual disabilities for an on-site coffee shop. Culture was part of the original whiteboard conversations, Bodak says, crediting its development with why Pendo can appear a lot more mature than it actually is. But culture and a flashy HQ isn't what gets a company through a public offering. David Gardner, a serial entrepreneur and founder of Co-Founders Capital, says companies at Pendo stage are likely feeling the pressure. Gardner, who has no direct knowledge of Olson's mindset, says big money rounds intensify pressure on an entrepreneur. When you raise that much money, the VCs are like a jockey beating the horse, he says. They want to see you deploying that money fast. They want to see hockey stick growth, and a lot of times they can push you to spend that money in a way that's not as thoughtful as an entrepreneur would like to be. Olson says his investors have been supportive of the firm's trajectory and that he's not yet feeling the exit pressure. Not once, he says, have investors pressured him to take a deal and offers have happened. I can guarantee you that no one is going to give me more pressure than I give myself, he says. Gardner says pressure is only going to build. Little rounds of funding can be little mistakes, he says. Big rounds of funding can be big mistakes. Gardner's advice is to not be afraid to push back against investors, something Olson says he's capable of doing. Mama says the biggest challenge in running companies Pendo size is the transition from building to the wash, rinse, repeat stuff of scaling. It's two different skill sets, says Mama, noting that in many cases it's time for a CEO transition. But that could be where Olson's TogetherSoft-honed executive skills come into play, as well as the direct experience of watching Rally go public from the inside. Olson says he doesn't plan to go anywhere, nor does he see a limit on Pendo's growth, as increasing trends in digitization create demand, he says, and Pendo is not for sale. That isn't to say if the right opportunity comes along, I wouldn't potentially take a different path. I have a fiduciary responsibility, he says. But I want to create a company of conscience, of consequence, one that is around for a while, one that has a real impact on the community, the industry. Olson says Pendo is preparing to be a company that is capable of going public. We are very fortunate that we are a company that benchmarks like public companies, he says, pointing to growth north of 60% for last year. The company broke the $100 million annual recurring revenue milestone last year, all indicators that an IPO could be looming. We'll see how this year unfolds, Olson says. He has to remind people that the company is only 9 years old and has to scale its systems without losing the entrepreneurial magic. Specifically, it's been maturing its recruiting process, adding hiring managers to the team. It's organized its board committees, also something companies do prior to public offerings. It has hired a new IT leader and is preparing for a big year. Olson knows there are those who doubt the firm's trajectory simply because of its age. When somebody tells me I can't do something, it just inspires me to find more ways to go do it, he says. The Raleighite. Olson lived in Raleigh, but up until Pendo, he didn't really know his own city outside the Flying Saucer and the five-star restaurant. He worked a lot. He rented near NC State University, just a mile from where he lives today, and had almost no friends, he says. He had friends from work, but when you're a 20-something executive, the people your age are not your peers. Olson says he didn't really become a part of Raleigh until Pendo. My teenage daughters still make comments that I was never around when they were younger, he says. I can choose what I do now. Now, it's common for Olson to bring colleagues back to his house. His kids have interacted with investors and early employees. When you create something, it affects your whole family, he says. He created Pendo in part to create a real life for himself, and along the way, he finds he's created a real life for others, and it's an addictive feeling. As Olson says, if you're going to work, why not do something you love doing? And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the continuing series, 52 Shades of Success. The headline, Building on Experience, How Amy Tang and Her Husband Have Drawn from Lifelong Lessons Learned in the Restaurant Industry to Build a Mini Empire, written by Connie Gentry. About this project, the 52-week project showcases accomplishments, challenges, and opportunities of individuals and businesses run by people of color, women, immigrants, veterans, representatives from the LGBTQ plus community, and a few other groups forwarding the mission of diversity, equity, and inclusion in the greater Raleigh-Durham metro area. The project also will delve into important trends and issues relating to DEI. If sales at her newest restaurant, Midtown Faux, continue on the trajectory of recent months, Amy Tang's premonition that she would experience luck if she opened a Vietnamese restaurant in Raleigh's booming Midtown community will likely play out to the tune of seven figures. With revenue running around $80,000 per month, Midtown Faux, which opened July 22, 2021, will top $1 million inside its first 18 months of operation, if not sooner. Tang has a lengthy restaurant resume that dates back to her early youth when she worked in the restaurant her family owned in Vietnam. The family moved to Raleigh in 1992 when she was 16, and her parents opened their first Raleigh restaurant in 1997 on New Hope Church Road. After about 9 years, they sold that restaurant and took a break for a few years, Tang says. Then my parents and sister opened their next restaurant, Far East, on Capitol Boulevard about 14 years ago. Her parents have retired, but her sister continues to run Faux Far East, which has proved to be a successful venture for her family. Despite opening in the shadow of the pandemic, Midtown Faux has ramped up even faster. It took my mom more than a year to get to this amount, $80,000 a month. I just opened this summer and my revenue is same as her already, Tang says, adding that it's because of Midtown Faux's prime location and also because food was cheaper and by default restaurant checks were lower when Faux Far East opened. My mom was doing around $45,000 a month when she opened, but I started at $50,000 to $60,000 a month and got to $80,000 quickly. My husband is very surprised since I just opened. Her husband, John, whose heritage is Vietnamese and Cambodian, is also a successful restaurateur in the Triangle. He owned and operated Mount Fuji Restaurant in Durham, as well as International Breakfast and Burger Company on Glenwood South in Raleigh, both of which are now closed. Together, Amy and John are co-owners of Sushi O Bistro and Sushi Bar, which they opened in 2010. She managed Sushi O for a number of years while he was running Mount Fuji in Durham. Mount Fuji was sushi and Thai food, and it was very successful, so when my husband saw empty space on Glenwood, he asked me to open a sushi restaurant. I told him I want to open Vietnamese, and he said, no, open sushi. Downtown people eat sushi more. So I say, okay, and then he put some Vietnamese food in the menu too, Tang says. Ultimately, Sushi O became a fusion of Thai, Japanese, and Chinese food, although Tang says the majority, at least 80% of the orders are for sushi. It's so hard when you have too many options on the menu. It's hard to do Thai, Chinese, and Japanese. But I made it work. Sushi O is very successful. When he and his partner decided not to have the Durham restaurant anymore, he came back to Raleigh to work at Sushi O with me. While the husband-wife team make excellent business partners, running the day-to-day operations together did not go as well. We fight a lot then, Tang says with a laugh. Meanwhile, her culinary dream remained focused on creating a Vietnamese restaurant. When she saw the location open in Raleigh's Midtown area, she took her mother, the most experienced restaurateur in the family, to get a second opinion. My mother say, good, very good location, do it. And that make me confident to open the restaurant, although COVID still scare me. But I feel like it will be easy since I already been through Sushi O, and I think it will be easier to build customer if only Vietnamese food. And it has been easy to create a loyal clientele, most of whom Tang describes as American, not many Asians. And most diners are coming from the immediate Midtown and North Hills neighborhoods. The name of the restaurant is very important, too. You say pho, and they know it is Vietnamese food, Tang says. My husband picked the name for me. He said the name Midtown Pho tells people where it is, and it is easier to remember. To finance the restaurant, they relied on money they'd saved, plus there was some financial support from the landlord, who was eager to fill the space, which had previously been a Mexican restaurant. The landlord helped us with like $35,000 to help build the bar, Tang says. We spent around $200,000 to open the restaurant, and the more expensive part of the restaurant is the bar. Like the landlord, her husband felt it was important to have a bar section in the restaurant because of the Midtown location. While Tang says the bar does make some money, most customers are drinking beer or wine rather than cocktails. With sushi, people will drink liquor, but not a lot of people drink liquor with Vietnamese food. They drink wine and beer. I don't think we need the bar, but it's already there, she says. The biggest challenges since opening the restaurant are the same that nearly everyone in the hospitality industry faces, labor shortages and supply chain delays. Both of the Tang's restaurants are closed on Tuesdays due to the lack of employees, although Sushi O was open every day of the week pre-COVID. In its 2022 State of the Restaurant Industry report, the National Restaurant Association stated that 70% of operators say their restaurants currently do not have enough employees to support customer demand, and most operators expect their labor challenges to continue through next year. An even greater share, 96% of restaurant operators, reported supply delays or shortages of key food or beverage items in 2021, and they expect these challenges will continue through this year. I'm lucky I found a Vietnamese family who just came to the U.S. a few months ago, and they work for me, but I'm trying to hire two more employees now, Tang says. Midtown Pho has 12 employees, and Sushi O has about 20. The costs are up for a lot of food, but it's hard to find everything, especially rice, paper, and noodles are hard to find in stock. I have to buy a lot of stock when they have it, even though prices go up so much. Noodles go from $90 to $100 for a box, and now it's $135 for a 60-pound box of noodles. Since opening last summer, Tang has raised prices on the menu one time. Lunch is usually busier than dinner. The restaurant typically serves 80 or 90 people at lunch and 60 at dinner, although there have been instances when dinner service grew to 90 or 100 people. The restaurant does to-go and delivery service using DoorDash and can accommodate large groups of around 20 guests. When labor and supply chain issues subside, Tang says she would consider opening another Vietnamese restaurant. And we also have two news items in the 52 Shades of Success section. NCCU student recognized for toxicology research. London Harper, an undergraduate student at NC Central University, received the Student Award for Travel and Mentorship in Non-Animal Toxicology, presented at the 61st Annual Society of Toxicology, or SOT, meeting the last week in March. The Student Award was established to support the education and training of students attending a historically black college or university, HBCU, who are interested in non-animal approaches to toxicology testing. Modernizing science is a hallmark of our work, and that includes promoting diversity and equity in the field, says Amy Clippinger, president of the Science Consortium. Clippinger also received recognition, earning the 2022 SOT Toxicology Enhancement of Animal Welfare Award for her work to advance non-animal approaches to toxicology testing. More than 6,000 people attended the conference, which was held in San Diego. Casino Night to raise funds for ADA in North Carolina. The Alliance of Disability Advocates North Carolina, or ADANC, along with Carolina Sled Hockey, is hosting a celebratory casino night to raise funds that will expand existing ADA services in the state, as well as create new programs to empower people with disabilities to live independently. Like ADA, Carolina Sled Hockey is a nonprofit that supports inclusion of individuals with disabilities. Carolina Sled Hockey works to enable adults who are unable to play stand-up hockey an opportunity to participate in the sport. The casino night fundraiser will be held April 28 from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. at Bowstring Pizza and Brew Yard, 1930 Wake Forest Road in Raleigh. Tickets can be reserved online at adanc.org for $75 or purchased at the event for $100. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. Franklin Street gets a boost. The University of North Carolina's run to the championship game of the NCAA basketball tournament was a lift for a town whose local businesses were slammed by the pandemic. The restaurants and shops along Franklin Street depend on foot traffic, the lifeblood of any college town, but much of that evaporated when the pandemic hit. Then right as the pandemic eased, Orange County lifted mask mandates on March 7, the Tar Heels went on an epic NCAA run that included a victory over Duke University in the Final Four. A crowd the town estimated at 35 to 45,000 rushed Franklin Street that night. "I was here and it was the most well-behaved madness I've ever seen," says Mac Gladick, the executive director of the Chapel Hill Downtown Partnership. Gladick says places such as Sup Dogs, Franklin Motors, and Four Corners were packed, so everyone has been reporting good numbers, he says. New businesses take off in North Carolina. North Carolina is setting a blistering pace for new businesses in 2022, with a record number of new business creations for the first quarter. From January to March, there were nearly 47,000 new businesses created in the state, according to the Office of Secretary of State Elaine Marshall. Last year, that number was 45,000 for the first quarter. In Q1 2020, right before the pandemic, that number was 26,000. These business owners are telling us in surveys that they see new opportunities to put money in their pockets and jobs in their communities. These are not folks who lost their jobs and have nowhere else to turn, Marshall says. March, by the way, saw 17,263 new businesses, the third highest total for a month year ever. The Secretary of State's office has been registering businesses since 1834. The torrid pace of North Carolinians creating new businesses has not backed off one bit over the last 2 years. It's only accelerated, Marshall says. The fact that so many people are looking to start their own business is a big boost to our state and local economies. Apartment demand rises in hot spot. Interest in apartments in the Midtown area of Raleigh, that is North Hills and the areas around it, is seeing sizzling action according to numbers from apartmentdata.com. The Midtown market is seeing rental rates of $1.86 per square foot per month, an annualized growth rate of 46.9%. That's easily the most dramatic growth in the Triangle, where most rates are up 13 to 17% annually. Chapel Hill Carborough, for example, was up 15%, and downtown Raleigh East Raleigh was up 14.2%. Intense interest in the Triangle is reflected in the number of apartments coming to the market. Occupancy in the market has dipped a bit to 93%, thanks to 4,238 units recently coming online. Another 4,469 units are under construction, and 30,893 units are proposed, the website reports. In North Hills, the 36-story The Eastern Residences just opened April 1, and 376 apartments and 21 penthouses, including three that start at $13,775 a month. Kane Realty tells Biz that more than 65 apartments have been rented so far. HBCU launches rowing team. St. Augustine's University has launched a women's rowing team that the university claims is the first of its kind among historically black colleges and universities in North Carolina. This effort began last summer and culminated with the American Collegiate Rowing Association recently approving the group. The team, which is already competing virtually, plans to move to live competition this fall. Indoor training sessions and virtual competitions have been coached by Mark Janis, a professor in the University School of Business, Management, and Technology. Coaches at NC State University, the Triangle Rowing Club, and others in the area have contributed. The five-person team, which was inspired by Howard University forming a rowing team in the 1960s, plans to double its size as it moves toward live competition. Shipping container concept coming. A small lot on the corner of Glenwood Avenue and P Street in downtown Raleigh is set to be transformed into a 14,000-square-foot food and beverage concept by Raleigh's City Plat and local Icon Hospitality. Currently housing an auto shop, the 0.32-acre lot was purchased by City Plat and Maryland investment group Medallia Capital in December 2020 for $1.5 million. Located at 701 Glenwood Avenue, the spot drew a lot of interest from groups wanting to build a tower and other large projects, City Plat's Gaurav G. Patel says. We felt the food and beverage operation would be the best fit for us at the location. With all the towers that are going on, we wanted to preserve what's existing and do adaptive reuse, says Patel, a restaurateur who joined City Plat in 2020. The project, called The Yard, will include an upfitting of the existing building and between 15 and 20 repurposed shipping containers placed on the exterior, a concept similar to the popular Boxyard RTP. And finally, ranch to sell meat in the Triangle. Wilder's Ranch, which sits in Sampson and Duplin counties, has started selling its product in the Triangle. Currently, Wilder's offers local pickup and delivery in Wake and Johnston counties, but the ranch plans to start shipping soon to other locations. The ranch sells Angus and full-blood Wagyu beef, Berkshire pork, and chicken. Wilder's is a new subsidiary of Riverwild, the Clayton-based development company founded by Reed and Jacqueline Smith. Riverwild has grown into one of the biggest players in the Johnston County housing market and has several large residential communities in the works. The Smiths bought the ranch in December because they want to branch more into agriculture and better educate consumers about the food process. And in some of our general news stories in the Triangle Business Journal, Raleigh balks on 40-floor request. In rare move, the council hits pause on downtown high-rise proposal. This article is by Caleb Harshberger. The Raleigh City Council isn't quite ready to hand out another 40-story zoning for a downtown property as council members weigh potential impacts to churches next to the site. During its meeting April 5, the council heard from the applicant and a trio of opposing residents regarding a proposed rezoning for the Reynolds Building at 316 Edenton Street that would allow development up to 40 stories. The property is currently zoned for 20 stories. The owner of the property is an LLC affiliated with Charlotte developer Trinity Capital. The company bought the site for $7.9 million in August 2020, according to Wake County Records, and filed the rezoning request last year. The property is next to two churches, St. Paul African Methodist Episcopal Church to the west and Edenton Street United Methodist Church to the east. St. Paul AME is a historic landmark and dates to the 19th century. The existing building was completed in 1910. If approved, the new zoning would allow up to 765 new residential units, up from 258, and up to 507,458 square feet of office space, up from 132,365 square feet. The new zoning also allows for more than 22,000 square feet of retail space. During the council meeting, the applicant asked the council to defer any decisions until May so the developer could add more conditions to address concerns related to the rezoning. Representing Edenton Street United Methodist, chair of the trustees, Pat Chrisman, and senior pastor Greg Moore spoke against the rezoning, raising concerns about the impacts it may have on their property as well as the St. Paul AME property. They also said that part of Raleigh isn't meant to see the level of density the rezoning would allow. Durham facility to make world's most expensive drug. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has given the green light for a global pharmaceutical company to begin gene therapy production at its facility in Durham. The Swiss drug maker, Novartis, has received commercial licensure approval from the FDA to begin production at its 170,000 square foot facility. The facility's primary initial responsibility will be to manufacture the company's spinal muscular atrophy gene therapy called Zolgensma. That's spelled Zolgensma. The facility will begin producing and shipping the gene therapy throughout the U.S. immediately, the company says. This Durham site is the second in the U.S. that the company has brought online to produce Zolgensma, labeled the world's most expensive drug at $2.1 million per dose. The site allows a manufacturing and distribution facility that began production in Illinois in 2019. Not only will this facility support the Novartis pipeline through the manufacture of both clinical trial and commercial products, it ultimately allows us to help more patients and families living with rare genetic diseases, says Christine Fox, president of Novartis Gene Therapies. And that article was written by Zach Ezone. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Tech Echo Devo page, written by Lauren Onasorge. Triangle workers seek new opportunities. Workers detail a wide range of reasons why they change jobs. Trey Atkinson isn't your typical tech employee. Until recently, he worked in the pest control business for a company that serves hospitals, hotels, and restaurants. Then the pandemic struck, and people got to see what things were really like, he says. Atkinson quit his job. Today, he's at Levitate, a Raleigh software startup founded by serial entrepreneur Jesse Lipson. Atkinson actually makes less money, but what he does have, respect. For Atkinson and many like him, the so-called Great Resignation isn't all about wages. It's about a turning point brought about by the pandemic, a fresh perspective that had him and employees like him thinking about their futures. Lipson says Atkinson isn't alone. New hires include former teachers and folks from the restaurant and sports industries. Scott Wingo, CEO of Spiffy, a mobile car care company based in Research Triangle Park, is also on a hiring spree. Those new hires include Nicole Haight, who says she loved her previous job at Teamworks in Durham. Haight, Spiffy's new vice president of human resources, also didn't leave because of money. In her case, it was the opportunity for advancement, the dream role Spiffy was offering. I was really enjoying the work I was doing, but I was looking to be more of a leader, she says. The pandemic had her thinking about her role and her own impact. I was at a place where there wasn't a lot of upward momentum for me, Haight says. But with Spiffy, she could run an entire department. A key factor behind the large number of people changing careers, particularly in the Triangle, is the number of tech companies in need of workers. And because it's related, we're now going to turn to the Viewpoint page to read the editor's notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor-in-chief of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, "To Stave Off Resignations, Offer Workers Ownership." In the past, I've written about the value of letting workers own a piece of the company to create a culture of togetherness, a common goal, and operational continuity. But while the movement gathered some traction among small businesses, large and even medium-sized businesses seemed reluctant to push the sharing of ownership beyond the ranks of senior management. But as they say in the world of capitalism, money talks. Quietly, some of the nation's largest private equity firms that invest billions in companies are ordering their portfolio companies to share the riches with all their workers through a complete makeover of the ownership pyramid. PE players such as KKR, TPG, and Apollo Global Management have all pledged to have ownership programs in many of their portfolio companies by a self-imposed date. This could be a game changer in many regards, but especially if we want to tackle the issue of inequality in an environment where wage increases are simply not able to keep up with the price increases. Workers today may be making more than what they did last year or the year before, but the inflationary pressures have removed all the gains from their wallets. At the same time, Wall Street has been on a tear, and people who own shares of companies have prospered on paper. It's true that workers in hundreds of thousands of companies see some of those gains through their retirement plans, such as 401k and stock options, but for a majority of American workers, the gains don't reach all the way to the bottom. Data from the Federal Reserve show the top 10% of wealthiest Americans held almost $15 trillion in stocks and mutual funds in 2021, an increase of nearly 18 times from the 1989 numbers. In comparison, wealth for the bottom 50% of workers hovered around $280 million by the end of last year. This widening gap in wealth creation simply cannot be sustainable over time before an economic revolution is forced upon us. A New York group called Ownership Works is working on that exact problem and has set a goal to create $20 billion in wealth for low-income and diverse workers in the next 10 years. On its website, Ownership Works cites several companies that have embraced the idea and are now stating all of their employees are now owners of the company's stock. And most of them are actually paying for the stock for the employees to own it. This is far different from offering stock options, and for private companies beyond a few executives, workers have no way of owning a piece of the pie that is being made every day. Today, companies such as Ingersoll Rand note all of their 16,000 workers own a piece of the company that collectively has added $500 million in wealth for the workers. Staffing company Insight Global LLC states the resignation rate has fallen to 14% from 45% after instituting an ownership plan for all of its 5,000 workers. What's different this time is the move is being started by the big, powerful, and influential investment community. State treasurers across the U.S. should take note, too. Public funds such as the California Public Employees Retirement System, or CalPERS, New York State Common Retirement, State Board of Administration of Florida, and many others could change the wealth trajectory of their residents and perhaps also increase the tax base by working with the companies they invest in. It's a plan that will not work if it's instituted by a few. It needs to be instituted by many and create a critical mass. And back on the Tech Echo Devo page, Outer Banks campground owner sues. The owner of an Outer Banks campground is suing over a local ordinance it says could cut it out of the beach tourism market just as demand is heating up. 85 and Sunny LLC, the owner of Outer Banks West KOA Campground, claims Currituck County's new rules will force campgrounds like it to cease to exist. In February, the county commissioners approved several new rules, such as a requirement that there be a 5-mile buffer between campgrounds and another prohibiting campgrounds on tracts less than 50 acres in size. But the new ordinance about recreational vehicles is at the heart of the lawsuit. The new rules amend the definition of RV to prohibit those that exceed a width of 8.5 feet in the transport mode. And now on the Greater Triangle Growth page, written by Evan Hoopfer, FedEx to put center in Chatham County. Shipping giant plans hub near the upcoming site of VinFast plant. FedEx is planning to open a large distribution center in a growing area of Chatham County. FedEx Corporation plans to operate out of a 338,000-square-foot distribution center in the small community of New Hill, a company spokesperson says. The facility, which is slated to open in early 2023, sits along Pea Ridge Road near its intersection with U.S. Highway 1. The FedEx facility serves as the latest example of the bevy of development happening along the U.S. Highway 1 corridor from Raleigh down to Moore County. The distribution center will sit near the future site of VinFast, the Vietnamese car maker that recently announced it was building a manufacturing complex that will employ 7,500 people at the nearby Triangle Innovation Point megasite. VinFast's investment in Chatham County represented the largest economic development project in North Carolina history. Also close by is the site of a future rail yard, CSX, recently proposed just down the road in Lee County. The distribution center will employ a mix of full-time and part-time workers, the FedEx spokesperson says. She declined to say how many people will work at the facility and says that information will be available closer to the opening of the facility. We continue to experience significant package volume due to e-commerce growth and are optimizing the capacity of our network to meet growing demand for our services, the spokesperson says. The site was chosen because of its ease of access to major highways, proximity to customers' distribution centers, and a strong local community workforce for recruiting employees. And in a section called She Said It, Lee Thi Thu Thai, CEO of VinFast Global, after the Vietnamese company announced it is bringing a 7,500-job manufacturing facility to Chatham County. "We would like to have the SUV and bus by July 2024, so I had to beg the governor, please give us the permit quickly so we can start building, because it's like 2 years away." And now we turn to the On Healthcare and Higher Ed page, written by Zach Ezone. Bioventus closes $450 million deal. Durham MedTech exercised its call option to buy a New Jersey firm. A Durham healthcare company that went public last year has completed the acquisition of a medical device firm in a deal worth up to $450 million. Bioventus, which develops products for bone healing, bone graft, and osteoarthritis, announced April 4 the company exercised its call option to acquire CardiHeal, a firm headquartered in New Jersey and Israel. The transaction follows the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's approval of CardiHeal's implant treatment for certain knee joint surface lesions. The call option is connected to a $15 million investment Bioventus made in CardiHeal in July 2020, according to filings with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Bioventus could exercise the call option at any time, and CardiHeal could exercise a put option after earning FDA approval of the implant device called AngeliC. That's spelled AGILI-C. As part of the deal, Bioventus is acquiring CardiHeal for $315 million, with an additional $135 million payable if trailing 12-month sales reach $100 million. The transaction, which Bioventus is funding with additional debt, is expected to close in the second quarter of this year. In a statement, Bioventus CEO Ken Reilly said the company plans to begin commercializing CardiHeal through its existing commercial infrastructure in the coming months. CardiHeal addresses an unmet need in joint preservation and cartilage regeneration for approximately 675,000 U.S. patients annually, representing an estimated $1.3 billion market opportunity for Bioventus, Reilly said. The transaction marks the third acquisition Bioventus has announced since its initial public offering in early 2021. Bioventus in November completed its acquisition of the New York firm Misonics in a cash and stock deal valued at $518 million. Misonics is a provider of minimally invasive therapeutic ultrasonic technologies and regenerative medicine. At the time, Reilly said the transaction opened up significant revenue opportunities as the company's commercial reach grows broader, deeper, and more global. In March 2021, Bioventus announced it would acquire California-based Bioness, which makes rehabilitation devices. That deal involved $45 million in upfront cash, with up to $65 million related to the achievement of certain key milestones. Bioventus reported revenue of $430.9 million last year, up from $321.2 million the previous year, and a net income of $9.6 million, down from $14.7 million the previous year. The company's adjusted EBITDA was $80.8 million. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Real Estate page, written by Caleb Harshberger. Boston firm opens its downtown tower. The Fallon Company plans more development on the Hillsborough Street site. With a dance troupe celebrating the moment on the side of the building, the developers behind downtown Raleigh's newest complete tower held a grand opening for the building recently. On April 1, the Fallon Company announced the official opening of 301 Hillsborough, a 19-story mixed-use office building. The project features 280,000 square feet of Class A office space over structured parking and 12,000 square feet of ground-level retail. Tenants include tech firm Pendo, which has leased the top five floors of the building, and law firm Nelson Mullins, which recently announced its lease of the 14th floor. The opening of 301 Hillsborough at Raleigh Crossing represents an important milestone for placemaking in the heart of Raleigh, and we're appreciative of continued collaboration with the city, the community, and our many partners who have contributed to the delivery of this premier office tower, Fallon Company CEO Michael Fallon says. Company chairman Joe Fallon says the company is currently in the design phase for the second tower planned at the site. The most recent plans for that phase call for a 20-story multifamily tower. Joe Fallon says the company continues to look into opportunities for future projects in the Triangle. The event also saw a collection of Raleigh business leaders and city officials in attendance, including Mayor Marianne Baldwin. Baldwin says the tower is a next-generation commercial landmark that will help downtown thrive. And now we turn to the On Retail and Restaurants page, written by Laura Brumette. Hillsborough Street site for sale, again, former location of service station for sale in hot area of Raleigh. A prime spot on Hillsborough Street in downtown Raleigh is up for sale again. The 0.3-acre lot, which was home for years to Taylor's Capital Service Station Auto Shop, drew interest at the end of 2017. The $1.15 million purchase of the property in downtown Raleigh had the potential to bring new development, located among several new projects in the Glenwood South area. The property is now once again up for sale, and the defunct garage still stands alone on the 630 Hillsborough Street lot, despite having site plans approved for a restaurant. The owner, known only as Hillsborough 630 LLC at the time of purchase, is Ohio resident Timothy S. Wood. Working with local restaurateurs, Wood had plans to build a new restaurant at the site, but construction never began. Wood says the original plans for the restaurant were terrific. "It would have been a real destination," he says. "The problem was we couldn't get materials, and we'd already spent so much time on the rezoning and so forth. It took forever to get approvals through the city, and we basically ran out of money." The property recently was listed by Sandra Simpson of Trademark Properties, and a brochure states that the call for offers ended March 14. The listing did not include a price. Wood is listed as a company official for several companies in the state, according to the North Carolina Secretary of State. Among them are Johnson Street Yacht Club LLC, a bar in Glenwood South that recently added a two-story slide, and Askew House, a planned restaurant from chefs at Raleigh's Fiction Kitchen and Bittersweet. Wood was listed as the managing member of an LLC that recently sold a downtown Raleigh property, 220 West Davie Street, for $2.57 million. He is also tied to High Point Group LLC, operating as High Point Properties in Ohio, and the property at 616 Glenwood Avenue, home to the Village Nightlife Complex. Wood is a former biology professor at Wright State University and founded Bryo Technologies, a biofouling consulting firm based in Ohio. Crabtree site carries challenges for buyers. Crabtree Valley Mall is currently on the market as a national trend sees many traditional indoor malls redeveloping into open-air concepts. But any new development at the Crabtree site will face hurdles. The property's risk of flooding is listed as high on state floodplain maps for both hazard and impact. An open-air center might be a better fit at the site, says Amos Clark, vice president of water resources at McAdams. That would have a smaller footprint than the existing mall, meaning less obstruction in the floodplain, Clark says. Floodplains cost developers time and money. For example, floodproofing is required, says Ben Brown, stormwater administrator at the City of Raleigh. The building has metal barricades in the doorways of the mall to prevent water from seeping inside. If an open-air center were to be built on the site, each tenant space would need to be floodproofed. Raleigh's first cidery hits trademark snag. Shady Grove Cider Company, Raleigh's first cidery, is switching names to East Bauer Cider Company before its now delayed opening in the new East End Market development. An application filed with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office by Shady Grove Cider Company, LLC, shows the request to trademark the new name. Two trademarks for the name Shady Grove are active, one held by Big River Distilling Company, LLC, and one by an affiliate of restaurant company Chewy's. Owner Oliver Koch did not respond to Triangle Business Journal. Koch was formerly the general manager of Trophy Brewing's State of Beer. And in more general news stories, we have an article by Lauren Onasorge. VinFast should be a catalyst for entrepreneurship, local execs say. VinFast 7,500 job promise in North Carolina could have a trickle-down effect in the entrepreneurial sector, experts say. Tom Rue, president and CEO of Entrepreneurship Foundation, NCIDEA, predicts entrepreneurial activity in the supply chain. There are going to literally be thousands of suppliers that are going to need to come together to support such a massive manufacturing effort, he says. It bodes well for the future of North Carolina that we know how to make stuff here, Rue adds. Lister Delgado, managing partner of Durham's Idea Fund Partners, says the 7,500 jobs tied to the project are unlikely to be competition for startups, as most local entrepreneurs seek workers in areas such as software and engineering. But Delgado sees the big benefit as one of branding. It starts to put the name of the area in the minds of people who are moving, he says. Jason Kaplan, co-founder of Durham's Bull City Partners, says it adds diversity to the job pool. For years, he heard concern from people considering a move. If the job that brought them to the Triangle didn't work out, were there other local options? Clayton delays Holmes' decision, written by Evan Hoopfer. A proposed subdivision seeking approval in Clayton will be considered further after the town council tabled discussion on the property. Plans for the Country Lane subdivision include a maximum 299 single-family homes, although the development team said during the council meeting on March 21 that current plans call for around 280 homes. The land sits along Country Lane, a couple of miles south of downtown Clayton. Cary-based Withers Ravenel is listed as the applicant, and application materials list Mungo Homes of South Carolina as the builder. The property owner is an LLC addressed to the Raleigh office of NAI Tri Properties. During the town council meeting, an objection was brought forth by members of the Tuscarora Native American tribe. As several people said during the public hearing, the site is believed to be a sacred burial ground for the Tuscarora. And we have a big number, 200, the number of new apartments coming to Greenville after the city council approved a new project on the west side of the city between Martin Luther King Jr. Highway and Bee's Barbecue Road. And finally, in the Triangle Business Journal, we'll turn to the Business Pulse survey. The question, is your employer increasing pay to offset inflation? The total number of responses was 213. 70% say no. 17% say some pay increases, but it's not enough. And 13% say yes. And we'll go ahead and stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. So long until next time, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.